was a great moral teacher, some say, but he wasn't God. Now, some of you in this classroom, in this auditorium, may have dealt with this question. I've had some of my family, I've had friends. It's not difficult to find someone that would say, I believe in Jesus, I believe in the
person. He taught a lot of good things. Obviously, he influenced a lot of people. But at the end of the day, he was just a good person. So that's the whole idea behind Jesus, Lord, liar, or lunatic. We're going to go through this and try to see if that's if those three, that trilemma, as it's called, is a fair assessment. So again, that statement, if you're in the debate world, if you're philosophers, such as William Lane Craig and others in the world today, they would call this a trilemma that you have to deal with in rational debate. Another way of putting it, maybe more layman's terms, is either he was mad, bad, or he was God. Okay, either he was a madman, he was a really bad man, or he actually was God. But it's the same thing, Lord, liar, or lunatic. Now, there are some alternates. And C.S. Lewis actually came back later after this statement, and he kind of refined this a little bit, because Lord, liar, or lunatic kind of assumes that those are the three possibilities and the only possibilities, and that's not a fair debate, because there are some other possibilities. One of those being, he could have just been mistaken. Not a lunatic and not purposefully lying, but he could have just been wrong and not really known it, not intentionally been wrong. That's trying to teach our kids right now. You know, Jackson will come in and he'll say, Mom, you lied. She's like, what do you mean? He said, you know, and he'll state, and she said, well, son, I told you that, and that's what I thought was true, but, you know, it was wrong. So it wasn't a lie. So you have to go through that debate with a six-year-old, which is fun. Or maybe the Bible's wrong. Maybe the documents we have are inaccurate. Maybe the history we have of this historical figure called Jesus are not accurate. Now, you probably wouldn't be here if you actually thought that, but that's not an uncommon thing for most people in the world. And those of you who have been in some of my classes, when we talk about the authenticity of the Bible, when we've played these videos, when you go on the street and you ask people, what do you think about the Bible? And what do they say? Well, I think it's, you know, it's some good fables and good stories and good words to live by, but I don't know if I believe it, if all of it's true. Well, I'm here to tell you that I think the Bible is accurate, and I think we have a lot of historical data to prove that. That's not the purpose of this class tonight. So, Lord, liar, or lunatic. Well, actually, C.S. Lewis was not the first person to kind of come up. This was not an original thought of his. He just kind of refined it and made it more popular. And we're going to play a recording of him. He has a thick British accent, so you have to stick with it. I'm going to play it again toward the end of the class, so what you don't pick up initially, hopefully you'll get toward the end, but we're going to hear him talking about this. But in the early 1800s, John Duncan actually is the first one that I could find anyway in historical records that had this idea, and he phrased it very similar. Christ either deceived mankind by conscious fraud, or he was himself deluded and self-deceived, or he was divine. There is no getting out of this trilemma. It is inexorable. So the debate is, we have to decide which one of those three things. He can't be one of some and some of one of these others. He either is a liar, he is a complete lunatic and madman, or he is who he says he was. All right, so again, a thick British accent. This is about a 4-minute recording. So let's listen to this as C.S. Lewis. This is from his book, Mere Christianity.
As in ambiguity is the kindest description we should give of his conduct. And yet this is what Jesus did. He told people that their sins were forgiven and never waited to consult all the other people whom their sins had undoubtedly injured. He unhesitatingly behaved as if he was the party chiefly concerned, the person chiefly offended in all offenses. Though this makes sense only if he really was the God whose laws are broken and whose love is wounded in every sin. in the mouth of any speaker who is not God, these words would imply what I can only regard as a silliness and conceit unrivaled by any other character in history. Yet, and this is the strange, significant thing, even his enemies, when they read the Gospels, do not usually get the impression of silliness and conceit. Still less do unprejudiced readers. Christ says that he is humble and meek, and we believe him, not noticing that if he were merely a man, humility and meekness are the very last characteristics we could attribute to some of his sayings. I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, on a level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to.
So let's take a moment and look at some of the claims that Jesus makes, and really the background for this statement that C.S. Lewis made, that, why is he saying this? Why is he saying this man has to be a liar, a lunatic, or Lord? Well, it was because of these claims that he made. These are probably all very familiar to us, but let's just review these. Turn over to Matthew chapter 11. We're going to certainly not cover them all, but we'll cover a few significant ones that I think really shed some light on this idea. This is, he's coming, he and John the Baptist are having this dialogue, Matthew 11. We'll start in verse 2. Now, when John was imprisoned, heard of the works of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the expected one? Or shall we look for someone else?" What was John asking him? Are you him? Are you the one that we've been looking for, right? That's what he's asking. Let's look and see what Jesus, how he answers. Jesus answered and said to them, "You go and you report to John what you hear and what you see." This is significant because he doesn't answer the question with just saying yes. He says, "You go and tell him what you've seen." That's way more powerful than just Jesus if he were to respond and say yes. Look at what he says. He says, verse 5, "The blind receive sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them." Not only did he say that, he was quoting that from the book of Isaiah, chapters 35 and 61. There are several others. If you have a New American Standard, you'll notice that that's in all caps, signifying that that's in a direct quote from the Old Testament. So Jesus wasn't saying this as just some catchphrase. He knew he was quoting from the Old Testament. So when he says to these disciples of John the Baptist, "You go and you tell John what you've seen," what in essence is he saying? Yes, I'm the expected one. But he's saying it much more powerfully than just saying, "Yes, I'm him." A pretty powerful statement. We've covered this a couple weeks ago. You know, the apostles are going around. They're saying, you know, some are saying you're John the Baptist, some Elijah. Turn over a couple chapters to chapter 16. We'll just review this real quick. Matthew 16, verse 13. Before we get there, any thoughts on that dialogue with John the Baptist? All right, Matthew 16, verse 13. "Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he was asking his disciples, 'Who do people say that the Son of Man is?'" Keep that phrase in mind, by the way. We're going to come back to that in a few minutes. The Son of Man. Okay, keep that. He doesn't say, "Who do people say that I am?" He says, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" Remember that. And they said, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, but still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter answered, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. So Peter responds and says, you are the Messiah. You are the Son of God, signifying that there is only one Son of God, as we see that supported by other passages. And Jesus said to him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona. He talks about this statement. Verse 20, then he warned the disciples that they should tell no one that he was the Messiah or the Christ. So here we have a claim that he is the Messiah. He is the unique Son of God. And he's claiming that to his apostles, and he's actually verifying that with him. So those are a couple of his claims that he's making. The expected one, he reassures John the Baptist, yes, I am the expected one that you read about in Isaiah. To his apostles, he's saying, yes, I am the Messiah. All right, let's continue on. Matthew chapter 19. So flip over a couple more passages or chapters. This is a really interesting passage here. So try to picture this. Now, remember, you've got a large contingency of the Jewish nation, right? So they're going to be very, very familiar with the Old Testament, with the 12 tribes, and historically how they've all been arranged politically and socially. Verse 27, then Peter said to him, behold, we have left everything and followed you. What then will there be for us? And Jesus said to them, truly I say to you that you who have followed me in the regeneration, when, here's this word, that phrase again, the Son of Man, and who is he referring to? He's talking about himself. When the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, you also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. This is a very interesting scene, because where is he placing himself among the Jewish culture? Head of the table, isn't he? He's saying the 12 apostles would be judging the 12 tribes, but the Son of Man would be seated above them, right? So you have this hierarchy that he's placing himself of. That's a quite significant claim that he's making. He didn't consider himself just an ordinary rabbi or another priest or another prophet. He's elevating himself more so than any other person that had come around in the Jewish community up until this point. He's considering himself, as I have listed there, the King of Israel, the Messiah, the head of the table, as you said. Any thoughts on that?
Back to John the Baptist. It's kind of interesting that Christ does not rebuke him or question why he's questioning, which he normally does with the apostles, frustrating themselves with him, saying, well, why, you know, amazing, how did you do this? He doesn't question John. And I think, I could be wrong, but maybe it's because he was in prison and he needed encouragement and he was questioning his own whatever beliefs. But I don't think that's it. I think it's because John got it. He got that he was the chosen one. The apostles, I think, got it in some sense. But when Peter says Son of God, that's also a phrase that was used in reference to kings. It was almost like a general phrase that was used. And Son of Man puts him in a category differently. I don't even know about that. And so I think that's why the confirmation with John the Baptist is so big, because he was preaching baptism, he was preaching repentance. The apostles had not quite gotten to that point, I don't think, of understanding that this was no longer a spiritual or a physical kingdom. And I think John understood that, and Jesus was kind of giving giving him his encouragement, his confirmation in what was needed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm going to use this as an example. I'm not elevating anybody. That made me think of, as an excellent point. I think John did get it too. How long did John and Jesus know each other? All their lives. Can you imagine Grant and Jackson? They're growing up together, right? And when Grant turns 30 and Jackson is close to that, I know there's Jesus and John were closer in age, obviously. And Grant walking into the room, and it just clicks with Jackson. He's like, "You're him." And that's what happened to John. He was like, "You're him." I think that's exactly what you see there. It doesn't come across as, "Are you?" You know, it seems more polished than with the apostles. I think that's a great point.
See how Jesus responded to questions from these people. Some were attempting to trap him.
Yeah.
Some were really seeking to understand.
Mm-hmm.
But because he knew their heart,
yeah,
he could see how he would respond.
Right.
Someone was trying to trap him, he would be firm to the point. But if someone were seeking, he'd be gentle and kind.
Yeah.
So that tells you about John.
Right.
And the response that.
Well, and that kind of answers a little bit of question. The question we have, remember, Lord, liar, or lunatic, it kind of lends itself that a liar or a lunatic may not respond quite so kindly. But
John knew when he baptized Jesus, the Holy Spirit came upon Jesus in the name.
Mm.
He had not known before. But that was a sign from heaven.
Yeah.
The Holy Spirit coming. I rather think that maybe the disciples of John could be discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, hear of Jesus, his mom, their leaders in prison. But, you know, there was a little friction there. The reason Jesus pulled away and mm-hmm. did not help in John's work anymore. And he well could have told his disciples, go ask Jesus if he's the Son of God, or is there going to be another?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That they would be able to see. And I know John was in prison and he would be weary, but my goodness, God told him when he went what was happening, and the Spirit came.
Well, and the takeaway from all that is, again, and you can go to Psalm, where John is asking that question. Psalm 118 is where this idea of the expected one is quoted, and so John is coming at him and saying, are you this guy that in Isaiah and back in Psalm that we've been reading about? And Jesus answers to the affirmative. So good points. Yes, ma'am.
You know, what Jesus responded is what we say.
Right. What we should say, right. Because if you just say, well, yeah, he was a son of God, then that's almost an empty platitude. All right, so he claims to be the expected one. He claims to be the Messiah. He claims to be the King of Israel. Now, this wasn't just a self-induced claim. Didn't other people know these claims? What was he crucified for? What was he found guilty? I mean, what did they put on the plaque above his head? They, King. Right? King of Israel, King of the Jews. So this wasn't something that he kept in his inner circle. It was known that is was his claim. Matthew 27:37, it's interesting in this verse also that, I'm sorry, I'm going to get to another. That's just the quote of what they put on the inscription over his head. I'll get to my next one in a minute. So, he also claims to be the Son of God. Okay, we haven't talked about that one yet. So Mark 12, let's turn there. This is the parable of the vineyard. Mark 12, verse 1. And he began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard and put a wall around it, and dug a vat under the wine press, and built a tower, and rented it out to the vine growers, and went on a journey. At the harvest time, he sent a slave to the vine growers in order to receive some of the produce of the vineyard from the vine growers. They took him, they beat him, and they sent him away empty-handed. Again, he sent them another slave, and they wounded him in the head and treated him shamefully. And he sent another, that one they killed, and so with many others, beating some and killing others. He had one more to send. A beloved son. He sent him last of all to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But those vine growers said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." They took him, they killed him, and they threw him out to the vineyard. You can continue on. The key things that I want to make here, obviously, I think we've talked about this parable before. The owner of the vineyard is God. The slaves that he's sending back would be the prophets of old. And then those at the vineyard would be the followers, the Jewish nation at the time. And his beloved son, obviously, is Jesus. So a couple of claims by telling this parable. Obviously, Jesus is telling this. If you look at verse 12, they understood what he was doing. You know, he wasn't trying to trick them in this. He said they were seeking to seize him, and yet they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke the parable against them. So they knew that he was referring to himself as what? What does he call him? What are some of the claims he makes in this parable about himself? He's the son of the owner. He's the son of God. That's in essence what he's saying, right? He is the heir. He is the heir. And this one seems kind of simplistic, but for maybe those who haven't heard the story of Jesus, he's also claiming to be the one and only beloved son of the owner of the vineyard. So again, the one and only, the unique son, the beloved son of God. So those are some claims that he makes from this particular parable. So those are some additional claims that he makes. So some pretty fantastic claims that Christ is making, this person that has come on the scene here in the first century. And these people are dealing with this. Is this real? You know, is he really the Messiah? Or is he just lying about this for some personal benefit? Or is he just a complete madman? So it is a provocative statement, but that's not really unreasonable to think that if we were living in the first century, we'd be asking the same things. Some additional claims. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 11, verse 27. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, good point. If we were living in other places in the world, we would have to, yeah. Matthew 11, verse 27. So here he really comes through with this claiming to be the Son of God. Verse 27, "All things have been handed over to me by my Father. And no one knows the Son except the Father, nor does anyone know the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son wills to reveal him." This is pretty brazen statement unless you're really this person. I mean, he's making a claim that I dare say, unless someone were a complete lunatic, for someone to stand in front of a group of people and say, "I am God, I am the Son of God." If you don't fear, you know, lightning coming down from heaven and striking you dead, then this is a pretty bold claim. All things have been handed on to me. We haven't come across that one yet. Okay, so he's claiming to be the Son of God, but another claim that he is making here is that all power, all things have been given to me. Another fantastic claim that he's making. Now, Mark chapter 13, let's turn over there real quick, because this is reminiscent of the passage we read about him being king over the apostles and them being kings over the 12 tribes or rule or judges over the 12 tribes. In Mark chapter 13, verse 32, we get this idea of how things will be arranged. But of that day or hour, talking about judgment day, no one knows, which, by the way, that phrase in and of itself is one reason that you can have a lot of confidence that Jesus was who he says he was and have confidence in the Bible. Why do I say that? Who in the world sometime later will go back and make up a story about a Savior who is ignorant about something that was going to happen in the future? He's saying, I don't know. Now, why would you write that unless it really happened? There will be no benefit in doing that. But anyway, that's another topic. But listen what he claims. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. So he gives us kind of an idea of the hierarchy, where you have mankind, then you have the angels, and then you have the Son of Man, and then you have God. So he's elevated himself. He's transcending human beings. He's transcending the angelic beings. And he is the only being between the angels and God. So another quite fantastic claim. All right, I want to come back to something that Megan had mentioned briefly, and this idea of the Son of Man. You're going to see a phrase when you go through the Old Testament, Son of God. And you'll see that that phrase used quite a bit. In fact, in Ezekiel, he refers to himself as a Son of Man. So forget the Bible for a minute. If you were to hear someone say, I'm a Son of Man, what do you think? What is that? Yeah, you're human. That's all. But let's look at how Jesus used this. Now, he refers to himself, and we've already seen a couple of them, but there are at least 82. There may be more. 82 times in the Gospels that he refers to himself as the Son of Man. Let's just look at a couple of them as an example. Mark chapter 8, verse 20. I'm sorry, Matthew. Thank you. Matthew 8, verse 20. Jesus said to him, The foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And also in John 3, 13. No one has ascended into heaven, but he who descended from heaven, the Son of Man. Now that one's interesting because you get this idea of no one has gone up to heaven, but there has been one who has come from heaven down, has descended, and that is the Son of Man, and he's claiming to be that person. Now, Ezekiel uses that phrase. Ezekiel refers to himself. In fact, the second chapter of Ezekiel, right off the beginning of that chapter, he refers to himself as Son of Man. The difference is, in Ezekiel, he refers to himself as a Son of Man, just as we would. I am a Son of Man, as are all of you. Well, all of you are daughters or sons, but you get the point. We are products of mankind. And that's what that phrase means. That's not what Jesus uses, though. He uses the English phrase passive, or the, anyway. He calls himself the Son of Man. God calls him that. Look in, or we read from Matthew 8 and John 3. Turn over to Daniel chapter 7. This is where this is really significant. And how it ties into, what difference does it make as he's referring to himself as the Son of Man? Well, in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a Son of Man was coming. And he came upon the Ancient of Days, and he was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. Jesus kind of hooks on to this phrase here in Daniel, and he, without going back and saying, hey, I'm referring to myself as I was referred to in Daniel, Paul and Jesus don't do that. But he's referring to himself as this Son of Man that's talked about here in Daniel. Did he do those things? Yeah. He came to the Ancient of Days, speaking of God. He presented himself. He was given dominion. He was given a kingdom. All the peoples and nations of men, every language, serve him, and his dominion is everlasting. So he hooks on to this, and we see the significance of this phrase when he refers to himself as the Son of Man. So another quite significant claim that he's making, that I'm this guy that you read about in these messianic prophecies in the Old Testament. Now, this may be the one that really topped the charts for a lot of the Jews. Mark chapter 2, and C.S. Lewis actually used that one in the passage that we played, his reading, not a passage, but from the Bible. In Mark chapter 2, verses 10 through 12, but so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he said to the paralytic, and keep in mind that this is a phrase, or it's referring back to Daniel 7. I say to you, get up, pick up your pallet, and go home. And he got up immediately, picked up the pallet, and he went out in the sight of everyone, so that they were all amazed and were glorifying God, saying, we have never seen anything like this. Now, you'll hear C.S. Lewis, we're going to play it again in just a few minutes, but he says, it's easy for me to say, Megan, I forgive you. But to say, Sandra, I forgive you for what you did to AR. That's what he's claiming to do. I mean, he has to be a madman if he's claiming that he has the authority to do that, or he really has the authority to do that. And that's really, you know, we have to struggle with that. We have to think about that. Messiah, Son of God, Son of Man, he uses all three of those when he comes on trial before he's about to be betrayed. Let's look at this account in Mark chapter 14. Mark chapter 14, verse 61. He's going to summarize several of these ideas. So he kept silent and did not answer when he was being questioned by the high priest. And again, the high priest was questioning him, saying, are you the Christ? Are you the Messiah? That's that phrase. Are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of the Blessed One? Are you the Son of God? Jesus said, I am. And you shall see the Son of Man, the Son of Man. This is a direct quote. Again, if you have a New American Standard, you'll see he's directly quoting there in 62 from that passage in Daniel. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. So here you have him. He is saying, yes, I am the Messiah. I am the Son of God. I am the Son of Man. He's taken it all. He's admitting all of that. And ultimately, that's why he was killed, because they couldn't believe that.
Sometimes a lot, or I felt this way for a long time, that sometimes it's hard to convince people that he's Lord, but at the same time, you just have to have faith, or that's just what the Bible says. And but it's not that way. It's methodical. There's evidence. There's within the Bible to argue that, because Christ, I think it sounds silly, but he wasn't stupid. When he came into the Jewish culture, he knew that in order to convince the culture that he was the one, he was going to have to use their culture to prove himself. Mm. And so the whole Gospel of Matthew kind of highlights the messianic fulfillment. It's all about taking the Jewish culture, the scriptures, and fulfilling those prophecies. And And to me, that gives so much credence to someone who could come and say, I fulfilled that. Rather, I mean, thousands of years. And maybe it was because it was so long. I don't know. Maybe it was fear. Maybe it was anger because they did want such a physical kingdom. But they all had scales, not all. Most of them had scales on their eyes and just couldn't see it. Just quoting what they knew, and they were an oral culture. I'm sorry, I get really excited about it. But they were an oral culture that knew this stuff back and forth. He was quoting that stuff to them. And there was a reason for that. He had to convince them. And a lot of times we think this is just a feel good, yeah, he had to convince them to say, I was God. No, he was a lawyer. I mean, he knew how to argue his stance.
Yeah, no, I think that's why I try to point out, I do it for my own purpose, and I'm glad for the translation I have when you see things in all caps, because he's just using this in his common, everyday talk. But he was quoting passages in just his regular speech. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Tom.
You know, he was prepared to compound the evidence for them. Can you imagine
right. What
it to go back and build cabinets, chairs, take care of your mother? From 12 to 30.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's just quick review some of his claims. And we haven't covered all of them, but we've hit some of the highlights. He claimed to be the Messiah. He claimed to be the Jewish king, the king of Israel. He claimed to be God's son, the unique, one and only, not just another holy man, not just another king or priest. He claimed to be the Son of Man that was prophesied in Daniel, and he had the authority to forgive sins. So what? So what he made these claims, Jeff? A lot of people have made some fantastic claims. So what does it matter? Many humans have made fantastic claims. Many humans have been crucified as common criminals as he was. What does it matter? The crucifixion, in fact, in many ways, was a catastrophe for his early followers. As was said, they were looking for a physical king. They were going to rise up, put down the Roman oppression, you know, free them from this oppression and rise up and establish the kingdom. And they were going to have this fantastic, you know, kind of return to Jerusalem from captivity, rebuild the temple, and it was going to be great. And he was killed on the cross, stripped naked and killed with like a common criminal. As a liar. That's right. So as a liar, his claims were false. If he was a liar, his claims were false, and he knew it. If he was a lunatic, then his claims were false, and maybe he didn't know it. But if he is Lord, then his claims were true. If Jesus didn't believe his claims, then obviously he lied. His claims were central to his teaching, so you can't sit and say, well, he was just a good teacher. Because if he was lying, then what kind of teacher would that be? So you can't say he was a liar, or you can't say he was just a good teacher, but not call him Lord. If he was a lunatic, then he was delusional and a madman. So again, how in the world could that be considered a good teacher or a good moral person? You can't have both of those. But if he was Lord, and he is Lord, which I believe he is, not only a great human, but claims and is God on earth. So how do we know if these claims are true? How do we know what's the answer to this? That's how we know. It's the resurrection. Now, we've got 5 minutes. We're going to try to talk about resurrection. So let's try to see if we can squeeze this in real quick. All right, so let's talk about the facts. Let's talk about the things that most everyone, whether they believe or Christians or not, what most scholars believe and would agree to. Most of them would agree to the basic sequence of the events of the early church, in that Jesus comes on the scene. He made some fantastic claims. Because of those claims, he was crucified on the cross. And after he was crucified, many people followed in those beliefs and followed after him, and the early church was established. Very few people dispute that. Okay, those are the facts. What they do dispute, what is controversial, is the resurrection. Now, there are a couple theories. There's probably more. I'm just going to talk about briefly three of them. So this first one is called the swoon theory. The swoon theory is, well, he didn't really die. It's one of those things that you would see in the movies where his heart slowed down, his pulse, you know, went to a very, it looked like he was dead, but he really wasn't. They put him in the tomb. He was unconscious. But he revived and somehow was able to push away the big rock or had some help doing that. But yeah, so the first, there are three good arguments to dispute the swoon theory. One, people didn't survive the crucifixion. I mean, no one who was crucified ever survived it. So he would be the first to survive it, not that he couldn't have. Second, the Romans knew how to kill, absolutely, and they made sure you were dead. They would break your legs to make sure. Jesus would not have been fit to escape the tomb, you know, given the situation he was in. And third, there's no way that he would have been mistaken for resurrected. If he actually did that and appeared to people later, which we have eyewitness accounts, more than 500 that he appeared to, they would have said something about it. But he appears in a glorious state, as we find in the New Testament, when he appears to them. Now, the hallucination theory is people were just hallucinated. They wanted to believe this so badly that they saw him. Now, if we just had one person, that would be okay. And even if we had 10 people that at 10 different events had that same hallucination, but that's not what happened from the eyewitness events. We have some cases where 20, 30, 40, 50 people at the same time see him. So there's no way you can get around that. So hallucinations are typically individual affairs, and what we find in historical records and in the Bible, this was not a single occurrence of one person. The conspiracy theory says that the disciples made it all up. None of this ever happened. The disciples made up the whole thing. That he had been resurrected. You know, they went in and they snuck and they got his body and they went and hid it. Well, if that were true, then all you would have to do is find Jesus' body, which no one has found his body because it was resurrected. So that's why he found it. But maybe they were good and they were able to hide it somewhere. Well, yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah, the testimony of those who had not followed Jesus is another thing. So why would people who saw him afterward, why in the world would they start following him if this was just a conspiracy? Yeah, and give their lives away. And we see these disciples, they are committed to the cause. They end up dying themselves, and that would just be, for a lie. You know, that's a big lie that all of them would want to continue to die for. Okay, let's listen to this one more time.
Among these Jews, there suddenly turns up a man who goes about talking as if he was God. He claims to forgive sins. He says he has always existed. He says he is coming to judge the world at the end of time. Now, let us get this clear. Among pantheists, like the Indians, anyone might say he was a part of God or one with God. There would be nothing very odd about it. But this man, since he was a Jew, could not mean that kind of God. God, in their language, meant the being outside the world who made it and was infinitely different from anything else. And when you have grasped that, you will see that what this man said was, quite simply, the most shocking thing that has ever been uttered by human lips. One part of the claim tends to slip past us unnoticed, because we have heard it so often that we no longer see what it amounts to. I mean the claim to forgive sins, any sins. Now, unless the speaker is God, this is really so preposterous as to be comic. We can all understand how a man forgives offenses against himself. You tread on my toe and I forgive you. You steal my money and I forgive you. But what should we make of a man, himself unrobbed and untrodden on, who announced that he forgave you for treading on other men's toes and stealing other men's money? Asinine fatuity is the kindest description we should give of his conduct. And yet this is what Jesus did. He told people that their sins were forgiven and never waited to consult all the other people whom their sins had undoubtedly injured. He unhesitatingly behaved as if he was the party chiefly concerned, the person chiefly offended in all offenses. Now, this makes sense only if he really was the God whose laws are broken and whose love is wounded in every sin. In the mouth of any speaker who is not God, these words would imply what I can only regard as a silliness and conceit unrivaled by any other character in history. Yet, and this is the strange, significant thing, even his enemies, when they read the Gospels, do not usually get the impression of silliness and conceit. Still less do unprejudiced readers. Christ says that he is humble and meek, and we believe him, not noticing that, if he were merely a man, humility and meekness are the very last characteristics we could attribute to some of his sayings. I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, on a level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to.
I'll leave you with this. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to.